If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife.
I thank my lucky stars to be living here today,
where the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me.
And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today.
There ain't no doubt
I love this, land.
God bless the USA.
God bless the USA.
From the lakes of Minnesota
to the hills of Tennessee,
across the plains of Texas, oh, from sea to shining sea,
from Detroit down to Houston,
New York to LA,
where there's pride in every American heart,
and it's time we stand and say,
now, well, ladies and gentlemen, Thumper, your host, Dan Happel.
Thumper, that is always powerful. Thank you. That's a great lead in. Although I wonder how free we are anymore, because it sure seems like they're taking a lot of those freedoms away. And today we're going to have a fantastic guest. We have some good ones, and today is no exception. Terry Turchie is a former FBI special operations agent. He worked as a counterterrorism specialist, and he was assistant secretary for the FBI special counterterrorism unit. And he's been involved with a lot of different programs. You'll recognize some of the programs he's worked on. And Terry is a tremendous patriot, and I've had the great opportunity of getting to know him through Mary Fanning, and Terry and I've had off-camera conversations, and I'll tell you, this guy's fantastic. He is going to be a regular to our program, I'm sure of that, and he is someone who really loves and believes in this country and is so saddened, so sickened by the way things have been going. And Terry, welcome to the program. Really look forward to hearing you and having a chance to talk about all the things that you've been involved in.
Dan, thank you very much for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I have to tell you, you're what I saw of you after I've gone out on the internet and done some reading and some research, I have to tell you, you are really an exceptional person. Mary was right when Mary Fanning told me that you were really a remarkable person and needed to be a guest on the program. And your recent book, In Their Own Words, I haven't had a chance to read it yet. However, I promise you I will be reading that before we do our next program. I will have an under belt. I have to tell you, you're absolutely right. They're not even hiding now all the things that they plan to do to us. And what we've seen in the last 2 months has just been extraordinary. It just absolutely extraordinary. So with that, I'd like to have you kind of talk a little bit about some of the programs you've worked on, what you did at the FBI, the different things that you got involved in, and then we can get into where you see our country going now.
Well, Dan, I used to get thrown out of the high school library because you remember that book, The FBI Story, mm-hmm. by Don Whitehead, and then the movie with Jimmy Stewart that came a little bit right after the book. And so I used to get that book, and we'd all sit at the table and talk about all the stories in there, and then we'd talk too loud, so the librarian would come up and ask us all to leave. But I realized then I wanted to be an FBI agent. And so I took criminal justice in college, graduated, was born and raised in the Bay Area, born in Berkeley, actually, and raised in the Bay Area during the free speech movement at UC Berkeley. And after college in 1972, graduated in May, I think it was May or June. And by July, had gotten a job as a clerical support employee with the FBI in Washington, D.C., and it was a real dream. And at that time, I was about 20, I guess. And you had to be in the FBI as a clerk for 2 years with your college degree at that point in time. And then you could qualify to take the agent's test. That was one of the ways to get into the FBI as a special agent. So many of us ended up back in Washington, D.C. I happened to end up back there during the entire Watergate affair, during all of the demonstrations that were going on in the nation's capital back then, and many of them were very violent, and kind of grew up in the middle of that, both at home in Berkeley and also back at the Bureau. By 1976, I got into New Agents Training Class 2, February 2nd, 2000, or 1976, and ended up in Portland, Oregon as my first office. And was working what we call criminal work, not counterintelligence, but learning how to do everything from bank robberies to crimes on government and Indian reservations and kidnappings and extortions and all of those things, until 1978 when I was transferred to New York City. And that was a real significant time for me because New York City was kind of what the FBI regarded then and still regards as its flagship field division. And it had everything. And it certainly had a massive counterintelligence program directed against the former Soviet Union and China and all of what we called at the time the criteria countries. So I learned counterintelligence in the streets of New York. I learned about the Communist Party of the United States in the streets of New York. And in fact, was kind of trained and mentored in some of that by the FBI's primary point of contact for the Communist Party. As an agent. And this man, his name was Jack Elliott, and bless his heart, he knew everything there was to know about everything going on across the country. And he would tell me, even then, he said, you should read some of these logs I'm reading today, Terry, you should read some of these things, and you'll see that these people are serious. Gus Hall, who nobody even knows who Gus Hall is today, but Gus Hall was the president and the chairman of the Communist Party of the United States back then. He was an American. And of course, he looked very harmless and looked like anybody's grandpa, actually. But on weekends and sometime during the day, we would actually surveil him and his wife, and they would be moving all over New York City. And what I would learn eventually is that the Communist Party of the United States back in those days was receiving $1 million a year directly from the hands of the Soviet KGB into the hands of Gus Hall in the form of a satchel that they would bring over here. They took two of their best agents and had them come over here every year And they would go through counter surveillance, and they would do all these different things so that they wouldn't be seen. And eventually by nightfall, they would meet and they would hand over $1 million in cash to Gus Hall and his wife Liz. And he would take that money up to his home in Westchester, New York, and store it in the attic up there, and use that money to finance the Communist Party of the United States and all of the misinformation and disinformation and all of the things that were going on at that period of time. And what people don't realize and weren't really realizing then is that the Soviets were playing the game for real. They would use the CPUSA, as it was called, and they would try and identify and recruit people inside of US government agencies. And eventually those people, and they would spend a long time trying to get those, quote, insiders to talk to them and help them. And many times their beginning of those relationships, nothing was being exchanged. They were just getting to know each other. That's very important today, because the term insider threat is exactly what we faced then and what the FBI tried to prevent. And today the insider threat is on steroids. And that is what we're trying to prevent today as well. But the Democratic Party of decades later has actually now tried to adopt into the party the ideology of communism. And what was also going on while the CPUSA was receiving money from the Soviet Union, we have all these demonstrations and protests, as they called them back then even, and a lot of violence, which was directed by two organizations essentially, the Weather Underground Terror Organization and the Black Panther Party, all of which grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area between 1967 and the 1970s.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned New York. It's also was kind of a hotbed for a lot of different communist programs because of the UN. The UN has always been a hotbed of communism. And obviously, communist China now is probably an even bigger threat than the former Soviet Union, what's now known as Russia, although I think they're still there. I think communist China right now poses the greatest threat this country has ever faced.
You are absolutely correct. And we've actually seen today how the Chinese and the Chinese government have made great progress in impacting and affecting and recruiting people, I believe, inside the Democratic Party, and have turned those people into essentially voice pieces for the ideology of communism. And that's exactly why my co-writer, my co-author, Don Bracken, who also runs History Publishing Company, started talking about a book that would kind of portray how we've gotten from where we are, from where we were over five decades ago. And what came during all of those discussions, and what bothered me so much over a couple of years, because the book was actually written probably now about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And by the time then it's finished and gets edited and published, it was out about this time last year, actually. But all of the things in the book preceded the riots that we experienced during the summer here in the United States, which were all essentially showing the mouthpiece of the radical left, which I really call the radical revolutionaries, who want to help impose a communist overthrow or overthrow the U.S. government and impose a communist ideological government here in the United States. And all of this can be traced back directly, in my opinion, to those days of the 60s and those days of the 70s, when the Weather Underground, violent terrorist organization that it was, wrote a document called Prairie Fire. And Prairie Fire is very significant because all of the language, I mean, we don't even have to embellish. If you start reading Prairie Fire, which is well over 100 pages, you find out that the Democratic Party platform, all of the words they use that are coming out of their mouth today of the leaders of the Democratic Party are nothing more than the same words, the same plans, the same strategies that was incorporated in the Prairie Fire Doctrine and the Prairie Fire Document, which was written by, and this is their own description, communist-minded men and women who want to overthrow the government of the United States. And Prairie Fire was the roadmap that I think is being followed today. So let me give you just a few early examples that I think really sum it up. Today, we hear a great deal about systemic racism. Just about every Democratic Party official we saw during the election run-up, all of the Democratic Party candidates for the office of President of the United States said America was a systemically racist country, an institutionally racist country, and that all of that had to be changed and that they would force those changes. So here's what's important. Those terms came directly from the Prairie Fire Revolutionary Manual. They said that the key to overthrowing the U.S. government, and they even admitted, we've tried violence, and violence doesn't seem to be working. We've tried burning down police stations and attacking U.S. government installations. We've tried all of those things. We've taken on the government directly, but we're not winning. We're losing. The FBI, the local police are after us, and we're eventually going to have to kind of disappear into the woodwork. But we're going to leave you with this document, Prairie Fire, and what we're telling you is you have to take several principles and you have to use these to fashion a strategy. And we're going to be back again. And we are still, and our goal is still to overthrow the U.S. government and the Constitutional Republic. So take this issue of systemic racism, take these words and play them again. And that's what we're hearing today, because their whole idea was these are the kinds of words that are going to eventually be able to divide people against one another. And they went beyond that. They said, look, you have to target the masses. You have to organize. You have to stress community organization. And community organization, in fact, is going to help us identify the appropriate people. And we're going to identify the victim classes, essentially. We're going to identify, in those days, they called them Chicanos. Now they call them the Latinos. We're going to identify the Native Americans and the indigenous people. And we're going to take a good hard look at the Black population. And in fact, we look at the Black Power movement as something that we have to join up with. And so the Prairie Fire Manual, and you have it up on your screen now, Bill Ayers, is his the introductory pages. And it goes through all of these terms. It goes through all of this strategy. And it puts a name with the strategy, Dan. The name is resistance. Where have we heard that before? Mm-hmm. We heard that in 2016, even before Donald Trump was elected and walked into the White House. The Democratic Party immediately activated a strategy of resistance. Even in the 2016 Democratic Party platform, people don't realize this, they spoke about systemic racism. They said anybody that doesn't get this in America is a systemic racist, and our institutions are institutionally racist. And what they get when they do that is they literally tell anybody who wants to speak up against them that we'll come after you and we'll embarrass you in public. Let me just read a couple things that are on your screen now, just to stress it again. These are the words that were spoken, and this is how these people identified themselves. We are a guerrilla organization. We are communist women and men underground in the U.S. for more than 4 years, and we need a revolutionary communist party in order to lead the struggle, give coherence and direction to the fight, seize power, and build a new society. That's exactly what's happening today. You can see, you can hear in your own words, when you hear AOC speak, you hear some of these other people speak, you can hear these same words. And what really caught our attention as Don Brackett and I were talking about this is we went back to the Barack Obama's inauguration. And remember his absolutely dynamic speech, and that can't be taken away. Remember how he promised a fundamental transformation of the United States of America. Everyone was giddy, but no one asked him, what do you mean? What do you mean when you say the fundamental transformation of the United States of America? Well, Huey Newton, one of the co-founders of the Black Panther Party, in 1970 gave a speech at the Boston College. And he said, the Black Panther Party is a Marxist-Leninist organization, and we believe in the total transformation of the U.S. government. And he went on to explain exactly what he meant. And what he meant was, as he's telling the audience, we believe we have to work hard and work with certain people in the white community, and we have to work together to try to overthrow the U.S. government through playing the card of race and systemic racism. And he had a very interesting explanation for this. He explained to the people that, look, we know the tension is out there in our communities. We need to take the opportunity to exacerbate that tension. And that is how we're going to force the revolutionary overthrow of the U.S. government. Today, you hear a lot of talk of reparations. Well, reparations, of course, were one of the main factors and main parts of the Black Panther Party 10-point plan. So all of this is now being brought back to us. But it's being brought back to us with a very nice word to kind of wrap around it. And that word is socialism. We're not talking here about the implementation of socialism. The Democratic Party is talking about the implementation of a Marxist type of government, a tyrannical government that attacks the Bill of Rights, that literally builds classes of people and separates those classes of people from the rest of us. And separates us by what? By some other words, white supremacy. White supremacy was mentioned 50 times in Prairie Fire if it was mentioned once. And white supremacy was mentioned and talked about in detail in the Black Panther Party 10-point plan. So all of these strategies, all of these techniques, all of these methods are now being brought back to us today by people then who actually told us we are communist-minded men and women. We are a Marxist-Leninist group, and that's very important, a Marxist-Leninist group. That's as clear as you can be. But today, of course, they're trying to spoon-feed these ideological ideas to people and call them by other names and wrap it also, not just the ideology, but wrap it also in the idea of the three watchwords. Diversity, equality, and social justice. Because again, socialism and those three words sound really kind of nice. Who can disagree mm-hmm. with diversity, equality, and social justice? I mean, it sounds pretty good, but that's not what they're talking about. They're talking about the definitions and the meanings of those words as they came from the Black Panther Party, from its 10-point program, which you have up on the screen now, and they came from the Weather Underground terror organization. Why are those organizations so dangerous? During the period of time for about a decade, a little longer actually than that, those two organizations were attacking the police. They were killing policemen. They were ambushing police officers on the streets. And they were trying in a violent way to overthrow the government. They ended up saying, look, we need to effect a political revolution, and we're going to kind of disappear now. And we're going to come back someday, and we'll come back with the strategy that actually helps this to happen. And that's what we're seeing now. The Democratic Party thinks that it has gotten the fine details worked out, and that it can convince people and spoon feed people into believing that it's going to do best for the American people by implementing what is nothing more, nothing less than the communist ideology of the 60s and 70s. Now, we don't have a Soviet Union anymore. Of course, it crashed. It crashed under the weight of its so-called socialist government, right? But we do have China, and China's very aggressive. We still have Russia with a lot of very dangerous armaments. And we have 90 miles from Florida, the country of Cuba. Cuba is very important here, even though it's very small, because the former KGB trained Cuban intelligence. They trained them in how to infiltrate and put insiders in government. They are one of the best intelligence services in doing that. What's one of the final things that Barack Obama did when he left the presidency? He was getting ready, actually, he already had signed on the dotted line, to normalize relationships with Cuba. And he did that through Raul Castro, Fidel Castro's brother. Raul Castro, back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, was the point person who worked hand in hand 24/7 with the KGB to make sure that the Castro government and its intelligence services were fashioned and modeled in the same vein as the KGB. So that's who we're now saying we're going to chum up with. Now, President Trump said no more of this. No more travel. We're putting an end to what President Obama did. But that's going to be coming back to us as well. So that's kind of a large overview of trying to connect where I was in the days I first came into the FBI, the things I was learning, the things I was seeing. You mentioned the United Nations. I had a significant responsibility with all the other agents in New York assigned to counterintelligence to worry about the intelligence officers sent here on behalf of China or behalf of Russia to actually have adopted the cover story of being at the United Nations as a diplomat or something like that. This is how the work is done. This is how they get here. This is how they do their work once they get here. And then they recruit and they work hard to find and identify people who share their ideology inside our government. And that's where the real damage is done. Imagine today, and I'll stop here for a second, but imagine today, as we're being told, we're literally going to watch our institutions once again have to deal with critical choice theory. We're going to hear that this ideology is now being taught to government employees who are supposed to be neutral. They're going to be continued with the propaganda that many of them, so they're very young today, a lot younger than I am, they're being told kind of an extension as government employees for all we know what they learned in high school and college only a short year ago. So they're already in the government thinking that, gee, my country, I'm ashamed of it, systemically racist. We need to change certain things about our history. We need to maybe even get rid of them. We need to not talk about them. And so you're all set up when the Chinese agent walks in the door, he doesn't have to do much. All he has to do is say, hey, you know about your country. You should be embarrassed and ashamed. This is how people get recruited. They get recruited about ideology and their thinking at the right time, not so much about money. And when they get an ideological recruit, they are the most dangerous kind of people you could ever imagine. Our government is now getting orders from the White House that these are the things you're going to do. This is how you're going to train. And this is what we're going to emphasize in the Biden administration. Think about that. Mm-hmm. Think about white supremacy and how you're literally resurrecting something that came directly from the Soviet KGB. All of these things, by the way, that we've talked about in the first few minutes, they weren't even the ideas of the Weather Underground or the Black Panthers. They were the ideas and they were the talking points of Soviet agents and Chinese agents and Cuban agents back many, many decades ago, trying to recruit Americans inside our government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Terry, I have to get back to something you were talking about, and that is how long this process has been going on. But Antonio Gramsci wrote The Prison Notebooks, and he outlined very specifically how the march through the institutions, as he called it, would happen in the United States, and that way in other countries around the world. He was in an Italian prison when he wrote it, but how the march through the institutions over a period of time was going to be how communism would take over, how Marxism would take over. And certainly Andropov mentioned that too. They came up with the Andropov plan when it became very obvious that the United States, in a head-to-head battle with the Soviet Union, economically, the United States would completely blow the Soviet Union out of the water. Communists are relentless. This is something people need to understand. They are absolutely relentless, and they will continue to keep moving forward. Even if they have to take a step or two back, they are constantly pushing for more, and that is part of their plan as well. And certainly Bill Ayers, you mentioning Bill Ayers, but Bill Ayers was the mentor, and many people say he was the author of the two Obama books that were written before Obama was elected president. And he was certainly one of his top advisors in the White House. And I have to absolutely agree with you that the term fundamentally transforming America had much more meaning than some warm, fuzzy, innocent sounding thing. He was literally talking about turning the United States over to communist agents and turning us into another Soviet satellite, another Marxist satellite in a world that, if people look, even since the fall of the so-called Soviet Union, and I don't think it ever actually fell. We've got quotes from Gorbachev that said, don't worry about it, we're just going underground, and things like that. You look at how many countries in the world today are living under communism, and it is about double what we're living under communism 30 years ago.
Those are all great points, well taken, and I agree with all of them. And I would add one thing to it. We had, during the Cold War, a lot of really tough times with China and with the former Soviet Union. Some of us worried constantly about what was coming next. But if you think about today, look at what has happened. We have China and we have Russia forming alliances with a country like Iran. Mm-hmm. Iran has no interest in some peaceful solution to anything in the world. Iran is a tyrannical country that is making threats against America's very existence every day. And now we have internationally, two of our most significant enemies, Russia and China, essentially forming an alliance with a country that believes in terrorism. It's a state that believes in terrorism to fulfill its foreign policy goals and objectives. Think about that and the significance of that, because we're not, just because we're talking about the counterintelligence insider threats, doesn't mean that at this day and age, we might not, in fact, get hit by one of these international terrorist organizations or by a nation state like Iran. And of course, it'd be very difficult to figure out who is hitting us with the next massive terrorist attack. But for all we know, there could be Chinese or Russian involvement in that. We don't know. You talk about decades of taking time to do all that is going on right now and to get to the point that they've gotten with the progress they've made inside the Democratic Party. But all we're talking about essentially is the pandemic, COVID, right? The worst virus that we face right now is the virus of the threat of China and of global communism and of the ideology of communism seeping into our very institutional veins. I mean, that is exactly what is happening. It is not a coincidence that around the world, as you mentioned, we're seeing more, if not communist kind of governments, more attempts by China and by Russia and by Cuba to cause trouble in South America, to cause trouble in Africa. We're seeing an uptick in that. And for a while, we were seeing this kind of recede, but not now. And so it's not a coincidence that all of that is going on while here at home, our very fundamental rights through the Bill of Rights, our right to firearms, our right to freedom of worship, all of this is all under attack. And people sometimes, I think, they hear all of these things, and they sound like so many disconnected parts, right? Your show is connecting the dots. Well, it's easy to connect the dots on this. You mm-hmm. start with the words, you go with the actions, you go with what is now being turned into public policy. And then you look at Barack Obama's quotes. He's made many of them, and they essentially say the same thing. Go out and make government officials uncomfortable. Now, this is, of course, when he's not in charge. Go out and make government people uncomfortable. And then protest and cause trouble. And then make sure at the local and state level, particularly when it comes to your police departments, you raise your voices, you attend meetings, and you then go out and vote. And you get the right people elected that you know are going to change the policies to the way you want them. That is exactly what they're pursuing. That is exactly the strategy. That is exactly the goal of the ideology of communism and of global communism now. Because the communist movement now is actually even more dangerous than it was in the 60s and 70s and the 80s, because now it is not so much the domain of any particular country, so you can't get your hands around it as well. It is something that they are now spreading throughout the country by virtue of their own power. And of course, we've helped China get stronger. We've helped it get more powerful. And of course, we've also in many ways helped Russia get stronger. The deal that we entered into with Iran was doing nothing for us. It was just giving Iran time to develop nuclear weapons of its own. And that's exactly what is happening. So you can see how things have changed, and they've changed for the worst, because we have an entire generation of people who essentially were raised in, let's say, kind of a communist free world. They didn't have to worry about the Cold War. They didn't have to learn about the things that you and I learned about. They didn't have to know what we knew. But now they're totally innocent. They don't even, when you talk about communism with young people today, many of them have not even had a one day discussion about this in school. And so they have no perspective. And when they then hear the political debate, they just discard it. Oh, it's those ultra conservatives. It's those people who are looking for, oh, I remember the lesson I learned about McCarthy, that guy named McCarthy. Mm-hmm. That's what they remember, because that's what they've been taught.
Well, you know, you mentioned education as being a huge part of this, and the Frankfurt School moved over to the United States to Columbia University in the 1920s with the idea that they were going to bring Marxism to American education. And they actually started penetrating in the teachers' colleges and in the university system all over the United States. And over a period of time, they've literally seized our entire advanced education system in this country. And now they're working into the high schools and even the grade schools with this crazy philosophy, this Marxist philosophy. And they use environmentalism. They use a lot of things that young people are easily led into as a hook to try to get them involved in the communist conspiracy.
After the Weather Underground was kind of dispersed, and the FBI had a program that drove the Weather Underground and Black Panthers essentially out of business, and all of the bombings and the attacks on the police and the murders and ambushes of police stopped after the FBI and the local law enforcement in America finally got the right program together to deal with it, it went away. But where did the Prairie Fire people go? Where did they end up as professionals? They ended up in America's colleges and universities. Just about, well, a huge percentage of them are talking to us now from those platforms. You mentioned Bill Ayers. Of course, he spent his career teaching. He was a professor. There are more than him. There are many of these people. Angela Davis, who was ran twice with the Communist Party of the USA as the vice presidential candidate. Angela Davis was one of the key Black Power people back in the 1960s and 70s. Angela Davis, and most people don't remember this because no one talks about it, acquired the guns, three weapons, mm-hmm. that were used in a shootout in a Marin County courthouse in San Rafael, California, trying to essentially free some Black Power advocates who were there, Black Power members, who were there in a trial hearing. The shootout ended up killing a state judge, and she escaped and got out of California. And who was helping her in Chicago? The Communist Party of the United States. They were working to try to get her disguised and then get her on a plane and get her out to Cuba. That's exactly what was going on. Mm-hmm. She went ahead to become a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. So the decades that it took to have so many of these people and their ideologies and their philosophy really hit home across the country in so many colleges and universities is frightening. But then they started moving all of this as the government became more involved in local education. They started moving some of this stuff into high schools and then junior high schools. And then, of course, all of the behavioral things that go with it. And so today, President Biden promises to be the most progressive president ever. So now he is looking for unions to really kind of turn up the heat on spreading this even further in our local schools and high schools and colleges. So we have a real challenge there in that we're already fighting from behind. When people are literally in school trained in propaganda, it's very difficult to kind of change their thinking or at least balance it. And that's what's happened because there has never been, and people here, when we get into these debates, we know what happens, Dan. The other side and the people who advocate communism, they can't run a country, by the way. Any country that eventually goes down the socialist path, we all know what happens. It collapses. It collapses of its own weight. But here's what they're really good at. They're really good at wordsmithing, and they're really good at taking words and putting them back at you. That's about the only thing they know how to do. And that's what we're having happen here today. We're having our Democratic Party throw these words around, make them sound like great principles while they are carving into our very government. Again, I said earlier, the government and government employees who should be neutral, they should not be taking a stand about a political ideology. And that's what this is. This is not about human rights. It's a political ideology. And now they're trying to get government agencies, law enforcement agencies, to start training people in critical race theory. That is their, and again, that sounds kind of interesting. It just sounds like some college type course, right? But it's not. It is intended to brainwash government employees, but more than that, it is intended to ensure that government agencies, and remember, we're talking about a lot of law enforcement agencies here as well, that are responsible for implementing and ensuring the rule of law in America. They are trying to use this ideology to completely change their thinking and completely change their way of training people. This is going to get people hurt. But it is also going to literally neutralize the ability of an organization like the FBI to protect all of our civil liberties. The FBI is supposed to protect my civil liberties, whether I believe in this stuff or not. And yet, what do we see what do we hear often now? We hear the discussion about the FBI's concern over white supremacy and white supremacy terrorist or organizations. Now the FBI is going to be out there making sure that it can find those terrorist groups and people to put into that little category because that's what Biden wants. But guess what, Dan? I worked domestic terrorism for years, and that doesn't exist. White people like Eric Robert Rudolph, who was the Olympic bomber and attacked abortion clinics and got way out of his lane on how he rationalized things, and then ended up killing a policeman in Birmingham, Alabama in January of 1998. Eric Robert Rudolph was a lone offender. He was not a white supremacist with a big organization thinking he was going to bring down the U.S. government. He was nothing like the power of the radical revolutionary left today that have permeated the Democratic Party and government institutions. So to compare an Eric Robert Rudolph or a Timothy McVeigh with that kind of ideology and the power that those people now have is an absurdity. And yet we're hearing the FBI tell us that, wait a minute, white supremacist terrorist groups are one of the major threats facing us here in America today. Well, that's an interesting statement from the FBI, and it's fact. That's what they've said. But guess what? If you look at the FBI's top 10 fugitive program, which reflects its priorities and the people it's looking for, you're not going to find one white supremacist on the top 10 list. If you look at the FBI's top terrorist wanted list, which is 26 people, you're not going to find anybody that's a white supremacist terrorist on that list either. Most of those lists, in fact, the top 10 list, about half of those people or more are illegal immigrants on our top 10 list. You don't hear them talking about that as a major threat. Every one of the people on the top 10 list is wanted for awful murders of people in the way they were done. And yet these are about criminals. These are about people who might be or have international terrorist connections. The only two people on all of these lists that are not Middle East terrorists or international terrorists or just criminals who have murdered people, interestingly, are Joanne Chesimard, who was from the Black Power movement of the 1970s. And Joanne Chesimard murdered in cold blood a New Jersey state trooper back in the 70s, and then fled to Cuba, where she has been ever since. She is being harbored by the Cuban government. And Democratic Party doesn't seem interested in that at all. So you see, when you look at the words, you take the 60s and 70s and all of those words from then, and you compare them now, and you set them on top of what the Democrats are saying, the words are the same. You've got some again up on your screen right here that I'm seeing, and you can see again that when Prairie Fire says it's taking a political ideology and wants to implement it then, but wants to have a strategy for the future as well to get rid of imperialism, we're talking about the same thing now, with just some of the words changed, but all of the other words in the strategy, including the word resistance, still the same and still there in front of us. And then you take the actions, and then you see the people that are coming up, Bill Ayers and Barack Obama, Joanne Chesimard down in Cuba, all of the same kinds of issues. The guy who heads the Judiciary Committee for the Democratic Party, Gerald Nadler. Mm-hmm. Gerald Nadler spent several years of his career as a congressman. What was he doing? Was he doing it? Was he working hard to get jobs for Americans? No, he was working hard to get Susan Rosenberg, another Weather Underground killer, a pardon from her activities of the 70s and the 80s. And in fact, Bill Clinton did just that. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at words, we're looking at actions, and we're looking at people then connected to people now who are people in power. And then we compare, finally, the Democratic Party platform with all of those words back then, and it's just, it's all there. It's all the same, and it's all directed at us. It's directed at the Bill of Rights and taking away from us the way we've lived in America and our culture, and it meets all the definitions of terrorism. And it's just a crying shame that they have gotten this far, and that we now, I mean, I don't know how you feel, but I wake up in the mornings now, and I'm not even sure that Joe Biden is making decisions or calling shots. Mm-hmm. I think he's just signing things shoved under his face, because we used to hear from Trump all the time, and maybe people didn't like some of the way Donald Trump approached things or the way he used certain words for things. But I'll tell you this, you knew who was in charge, and you knew another thing. You knew nobody from overseas was going to mess with the United States. You felt kind of safe in your own house, and you felt like your rights were being protected. I don't feel that way today. I'm very concerned about what is going through the White House. And, you know, they talk about transparency. They don't even know the definition of transparency. They never have. And so we now consequently find all of the serial liars from the Obama administration have new jobs in the Biden mm-hmm. administration. So this is why this is so important. I'm going to read some of these that you just put up on your screen. And it just gives people an example of what I just was trying to point out. And it's about the words. The Weather Underground, and as I read this, by the way, I hope your audience just thinks about today, about yesterday, about current events, about the way things are going and what we heard during the campaign for president. Because you don't have to think too deep or too far and just think about these words. They're all the same. The Weather Underground identified the many faces to militant resistance, attacks on the police, International Women's Day marches, demands for control and power through the seizures of institutions. Just think about that. Remember the big photo op where all the, I'm going to go out on a limb here, I think it was all the female Democratic congresswomen came out on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, all dressed in white or red or something, in honor of International Women's Day. Well, that's fine, I guess. I mean, I'm not, I mean, I've never said a bad thing about women in my life. It's not in my nature, but I'll tell you this. International Women's Day is not a U.S. holiday. I mean, this came out of the former Soviet Union and has its own story to it. And fine, let's celebrate women, but I don't know that we have to celebrate International Women's Day with all of the connotations that that has. But here you see the Weather Underground looks at it as one of the many faces to militant resistance. Mm-hmm. So that's really kind of changed, hasn't it? The perception today that they're trying to bring us along to believe. Hillary Clinton, she said after she lost, "I'm going to do everything I can to support the resistance." That's her quote. Nancy Pelosi, that first summer that President Trump was president and in the White House, impressed upon her followers, "This resistance summer is so important." She was down in Texas when she said that. The Weather Underground looked at America and concluded institutionalized racism is mainlined and perpetuated over the generations by the schools, by immigration laws, by birth control, by the army, by the prisons. Of course, if you look at the Democratic Party platform today, all those categories of topics are on the priority list. The priority list to move government back into the schools to teach things in a certain way, the open borders and immigration. And really, when you read Prairie Fire and they get into a major discussion on immigration, they essentially say that, look, we don't need borders. Why does America have borders? Why does America have laws that prevent immigrants from being in America? Because it is a country that basically was taken from other people. So they're already kind of starting to try and connect those two ideologies and those two ideas. The 2016 Democratic Party platform pledge, Democrats will fight to end institutional and systemic racism in our society. We will challenge and dismantle the structures that define lasting racial, economic, political, and social, and this is important, inequity, social inequity. That is something that is totally different even than equality, because that is essentially saying it doesn't matter anymore about equality. What matters is that we'll take from whoever we have to give the perception that we have kind of made everything equitable with other groups, which we have concluded are groups who are at a severe disadvantage. That isn't the role of the U.S. government. The role of the U.S. government is to provide equal opportunity for everyone and good education so that everyone could get ahead. I doubt if any of us would care if they took all kinds of money and tried to help minority categories of people get a freer education. But we don't need mass free education in America for every student coming into American school, whether they're from China or anywhere else. I mean, that's an absurdity, as well as so many of these other issues are. Elizabeth Warren, during the debate, she was insistent. Our criminal justice system, it's racist front to back. And then she went on to say she wants a race-based criminal justice system. Think about that. Mm-hmm. Think about the ramifications of that and what that means coming out of the mouth of this intellectual and professorial type academician. I mean, this is absolutely incredible. She knows, she showed one thing there. She understands nothing about the rule of law, nothing. She wanted to be the president of the United States of America. And somehow in all of her years of education and educating other people, she's missed something. The reason America has prospered so quickly and grown so quickly and has had so many people become so successful and feel like they can get whatever they want in this country if they work hard for it, she's taken the rule of law and essentially said, that's not the way we're going to run things. We're going to have race-based laws. Well, then tomorrow, the next day, the next week, what are we going to base our laws on then? We will essentially have no laws. Social justice, the idea of race-based laws mean no justice. And that is exactly where we're driving to. If you attack the police long enough and you kind of drive a wedge between the trust and the faith the American public has in law enforcement and the police, and at the same time, if you try to undermine the rule of law in America, which is based on equal opportunity and equal justice, It's about your behavior. It's not about your color. It's not about your sex. It's about your behavior and what you do to others on the street. If we change all that, we will have no law. We will have no order. We will have no stability. And it's just amazing. But this is what these people talk about. Where did they get it all? It all came right out of the Weather Underground's prairie fire. It all came right out of the Black Panther Party 10-point plan. So I want to cover one more of these for now. The Weather Underground listed its categories. We talked about this a little earlier, but this is very comprehensive, so it makes a lot of sense. And it called oppressed and subjugated people, Blacks, Puerto Ricans, Chicano, Indian people, women. And the whole idea was to join in an international solidarity, bring all those categories of people together. And they would, on an international as well as a scale in the U.S., they would fight against that oppression. And they would overthrow the governments that cause it. And they would institute the socialist utopia, which even they say is not about socialism. It's about a kind of a break in the action until we get to communism. Well, what are the Democrats now saying in their own documents? They talk about Latinos, Native Americans, Asians, women, gays. So you can see they're adopting all of this. And almost right now, it's right in front of us. They just put it in the same order even. So there's no question in my mind, having worked on the streets for 30 years, having worked both counterintelligence and terrorism, having arrested a Soviet KGB spy in New York City in 1989, having followed Gus Hall and his wife around New York City for 8 years, having done all these things, having read so many things, having talked to people who worked on our behalf to fight this kind of stuff, to prevent it from happening, that it's happening right in front of us. And we should have seen it coming when President Obama, in his first year in office, I think it was, he traveled all over the world. And the message he took after being elected as president of the United States, I mean, remember how hopeful we are. Even if people didn't vote for him, it was a great feeling. Look what we've done. We all thought we'd kind of took a huge step. You cannot be racist and vote for a man who's black to be president. That is inconsistent. It just doesn't make sense. And yet we did. And those of us who didn't still wished him well. What was the first thing he did? He traveled all over the world to talk about America's dark past. The things we don't want to talk about and mention, but we know are there. That was how he started off. And then when a policeman doing his job and doing it right up I think it was kind of up by Harvard, approached a house with Professor Henry Gates, I think it was up there, black professor who was seen by a neighbor. The neighbor thought he was breaking into his house, but it was the professor's house, right? But they called the police. They did what they did. They did the right thing. When the police showed up, he wouldn't let them in, and then he started yelling all these kinds of things at them and accusing them of being racist. And the president of the United States took that and ran with it. And we were right back. We now had brought back into America what we left behind, we thought, the idea that the police are racist. But you see, you have to do that. Now, we've gone a long way from that. I mean, we're in huge trouble now with telling people to kneel and expecting police to kneel on the streets and attacking them and spitting at them and all the other things that are happening. But that doesn't surprise me. It shouldn't surprise any of us. Because if you know what the Weather Underground and the Black Panther Party and the Black Power Movement advocated, and you know what President Obama ushered back into America, it shouldn't surprise us that we watched this summer as this was like put in a totally different level and totally brought back to us and will tear us apart now with all the other things that have happened. But you have to attack the police and you have to attack the rule of law if, in fact, you want to overthrow the constitutional republic. And that's exactly what is happening. And who is doing it? The Democratic Party. We watched this week a process and a event that should cause us all to feel just ashamed. And that is the impeachment number two attempt of former President Trump. That was completely uncalled for. How come after all those months of campaigning, when we were told we are going to take hold, we're going to get into power, we're going to clear up this COVID thing, we're going to unify the country, we're going to be united around getting people back to work, none of that's happened. We've seen people put out of work, people put out of jobs. Of course, that's nothing yet. When the full brunt of the climate change policies hit us, and we have seen the president attacked for many more weeks while they try to impeach him again. This is more of the same. More of the same is coming, only it's going to be on steroids. And in this book, in fact, we predicted that we were going to see a lot of violence in the coming days, and we were predicting that long before the summer of 2020. It was the bottom line of the book, essentially, because if you believe what we believe, and I do believe this, I believe this with all my heart, what is going on in America today, it's tragic. But if you believe it, then you know that eventually the violence part has to come. And who would have thought, for example, that the same people who are accusing the president, or accused and failed to be convincing, of inciting a riot, who would have thought that they could say that with a straight face when, in effect, they were bailing out the leaders of protest in major cities as police departments were burning to the ground and police cars were being destroyed and turned over? Who would have thought that the same person could call one thing an insurrection and say the other thing is social justice? This is what communism is. Mm-hmm. This is the game that you play when you're this far into it. And we're a long way into it, Dan.
Well, Terry, everything that you've said is 100% spot on. And what they do is they accuse us of the things that they are actually doing themselves. And the United States of America, prior to the Obama administration, was, I think, the least sexist, racist, homophobic, you name it, country in the entire world. And what they've done is they've tried to slice and dice our culture to the point where they create all this divisiveness, all this friction, all this hatred of one another. And what they do is use the same things that they are guilty of, and they accuse the conservatives of doing those things. And then they turn around and act like they had nothing to do with it. And meanwhile, they're the ones that are causing all the problems.
Well, again, Dan, I couldn't agree more. And as you were talking, it made me think of something very interesting. And it's important that we talk about this. People have to realize that we haven't changed. You and I haven't changed. Many of us who are conservative and have conservative values haven't changed at all. What has changed is the Democratic Party. It is not the party of John F. Kennedy. It is not the president, whether people liked him or not. He understood the threat posed by communism and the communist empire. He really got it. And he talked about it even in his inaugural address. And he told us it's going to be a long twilight struggle. And he was right. But today, those people would not even give him a second look, because they're now all about taking the ideology of communism, and even if they can't convince us of how great it would be for all of us, they don't care about that anymore. They will impose it, and that's what they're getting ready to try and do. They're trying to literally destroy the underpinnings of our constitutional republic. And here's what's really ironic, and I thought about this as you were making some points there, and it shows you, and it's proof, that they've changed, not us. You remember, of course, a bad period in the chapter of our country and in the FBI called Ruby Ridge. Mm-hmm. And for the people who weren't around then, it was a terrible shootout, and it involved a family, and it involved a man named Randy Weaver. And it caused just a lot of turmoil and a lot of soul searching. And the FBI was on trial because it was an FBI agent who shot his wife during this standoff. Now, all kinds of FBI officials were called before the U.S. Congress to hearings. And those hearings went on for a long time, a long time. And the FBI felt bad about what happened too. But the point is, this is what happens when you challenge armed law enforcement officers over whatever the issue is. And that's what happened up at Ruby Ridge. But here's the problem. Back then, the attack on the FBI's conduct was led by none other than the same guy who led the impeachment trial last week, Patrick Leahy. And Patrick Leahy just was all over the FBI then for what it did to Randy Weaver. Now, put aside everything you may think, today, that same Democratic Party would look at Randy Weaver as a white supremacist. Mm-hmm. We have totally changed where we were then from where we are now. Now, I can talk about Randy Weaver because I actually met him when I was in North Carolina. And I met Colonel Bo Greitz, who was also out there in the mountains of North Carolina. Now, I have to tell you something, and I've never told this story before, Dan. I'm going to tell it to you now. I was approached one day. Now, keep in mind, we have heavily armed FBI agents looking for the Olympic bomber, Eric Robert Rudolph, the man who is alleged at that time and now convicted and serving prison time for killing, 2 years later, a police officer in Birmingham, Alabama. This man was very, very dangerous, okay? And so we had a lot of federal law enforcement officials there. For a year, we ran the largest and longest tactical deployment that has happened in federal law enforcement. We had 25 federal, local, and state agencies up on the mountains near Murphy and Cherokee and Asheville, North Carolina. And so every day was a new adventure trying to keep the lid on things. Nobody's ever heard of that or thinks much about that that year now that I spent up there. Because guess what, Dan? We kept everything appropriate and we kept our relationship going with the citizens who did not want us there. But we kept repeating the same message. We know you don't like us. We know that we are not wanted here. But all we need to do, all we want to do is get Eric Rudolph, safely get him out of the woods and let him stand trial. Let him have his day in court. That's all we want to do. We're not here to go after you or the quote militias or anyone else. And that's the message we preached. And it worked because you can't name an event that came out of our 1 year with all those heavily armed agents on that mountain because none happened. Mm-hmm. But here's what did happen. One of the agents or one of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation people came to me and said, he was one of the commanders there. Terry, just heard that Colonel Greitz is going to show up with a group of militia people, and they're going to help look for Eric Rudolph in the woods. Now, of course, that's a nightmare if you're an FBI agent responsible for keeping the lid on things, right? So then the absolute worst part of it came. I got a call. I got a message from FBI headquarters. Well, look, yeah, we've heard the word. We've heard that Colonel Greitz and Randy Weaver are heading for the mountains of North Carolina and that the so-called Detroit militia will be with them. So here are your instructions. You're not to have anything to do with them. You're not to see them. You're not to meet them. You're not to talk to them. So imagine how you would feel if you're responsible for all that's going on up there and you've now been told that you're not even to talk to these people. So I did what I hope any, red-blooded, at that time, semi-younger FBI agent would do, especially if you had those responsibilities and you were accountable. I said, well, the hell with that. And the Georgia Bureau of Investigation commander and myself went to a hotel, waited in the circular drive for the SUVs to show up. And here they come. And they picked us up and took us to the compound after they arrived. We go in there and all these people are armed. And we go into a trailer. And about 2 minutes later, who walks into the trailer to be with Bo Greitz? His right-hand man, Randy Weaver. And here's what I have to say, why I'm telling you that story. I had all kinds of things I could have thought about Randy Weaver. And I mean, the history that was there, the moment we were standing there and what we were about to sit down and try to work out to keep the lid on things. And And it was the worst possible scenario to have all this happen. And the only thing that I could think of to do is extend my hand and shake his and sit down and have a civil conversation. And we did. And a week later, all the militia and Randy and Bogreitz had left and continued on. My point is this. All of these people are people. They have bad things happen, or bad things can happen when you get involved with law enforcement. But you can also understand and control what happens and realize that people are generally all the same. I do not have bad feelings about the people I met in North Carolina. In fact, I still hear from many of them. One of the people who was labeled a white supremacist was a key person who turned out to help us in the Eric Rudolph search. And he told me when I first walked into his place that I would never talk to an FBI agent. I don't intend to start. And I don't think you guys should be here. And then he turned around and he ended up helping us for what turned out to be several years. Because we were face to face and got to know each other and got to understand where we were coming from. You don't have to have all this hate generated. And what I see now, and the reason I told you that story, every day you can't pick up a New York Times or a Washington Post or hear from a Democratic Party politician or even, and I'm sad and heartbroken to say, even from sometimes an FBI official, you can't hear anything, but yep, we're all after the white supremacists now. I'd like somebody someday to ask, what is a white supremacist? Mm-hmm. Could you give us a definition? Is it a person who walks into a church on Sunday morning? Is it a person who doesn't believe in abortion? Is it a person who believes that they should have the right to bear arms? Are those white supremacists? Well, if you listen to some of these people, the answer to that is yes. Mm-hmm. That is dangerous. And yet the same FBI director, Chris Wray, was sitting in the chair when a bureau report came out about black extremism in America. This was during the Trump administration. He was summoned by Cedric Richmond and Gregory Meeks to the Congress, and he was asked point blank, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? Define black extremism? Are we back in the ages of the FBI conducting wild witch hunts? And calling people by these kinds of titles, we demand that you stop doing this. Essentially, they said, we want you to tell us that you're going to pull the plug on a black extremism in America type program when it comes to domestic terrorism. He said, I'll get back to you. Well, he just quietly buried that report and rolled the black extremism program into the general domestic terrorism program. And today all we hear about in the domestic terrorism program is the danger posed, the number one threat of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. It's not there, Dan, and it's not going to be there no matter how hard they dig. They're going to find people. And the more the government pushes these lines, they're going to find people who make bad judgments and decide they're going to take the law into their own hands. They're not the white supremacist that is going to overthrow the government. They're people who've had it and they make bad decisions and they get themselves in the middle of this.
Hey, Terry.
Same.
If I might, you were asking who a white supremacist is. And on my show earlier this morning, I came across this article. This might help you out. White supremacy is to blame for non-white people bashing, abusing animals. So start with abusing animals. This woman put out this leftist professor claims that kindness to dogs is racist and leads to white supremacy.
That's pretty unbelievable, Bumper.
It's enough to make you bite your cheek, huh?
Yeah. I just am speechless. I'm not usually speechless that often, but what do you say? What and so how do you go back to someone like that and have a rational discussion?
You can't.
Yeah.
You can't, Terry. You can't have a rational discussion with these people. And You know, your point about Randy Weaver and Bo Greitz and some of those folks, I met Randy Weaver, and I'll tell you, an awful lot of people out there that ended up in very difficult situations got there because they were targeted specifically with the idea that somebody's going to find something that they can put them in jail for or that they can use against them. And that's exactly the kind of terrorism that I see going on today in the United States that is being used against just good, patriotic, red-blooded Americans. And what they'll do is they'll pick and choose. They'll go after one person and they'll use this as a way to take out all the people who they think are leaders or important in the freedom movement.
Exactly. And how many times over six decades have we heard the Democratic Party use the word insurrection to describe protests and riots and attacks on police? Never. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Never. And if you look at what happened at the Capitol riot in January, and you look at the five specific people that lost their lives, I mean, none of that was because of Donald Trump. And it was something that got out of hand. It was something that happens when you have all of that emotion in such significant issues. But all of the things that they tried to make this look like, it wasn't. And yet they use the word insurrection. They put thousands of National Guard troops in Washington now to surround them. What message are they trying to give? Are they now saying that, look, we've taken over the government, and by golly, you're not going to get in here and hurt us when you figure out what's happened? And, you know, what are they trying to say to us? I mean, I have to tell you, I told you earlier, I do not wake up in the mornings feeling safe and think that I feel okay, but our country is safe from all that we face here. I remember there's an author, Ronald Kessler, in fact. And I bring this up because I think that it's just scary. And, you know, everybody talks about Joe Biden and having dementia and all of this. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. I don't know. But here's what happened when he definitely had no dementia. He had nothing. He was the vice president for 8 years. He was responsible and accountable for having the Secret Service detail there with the nuclear football. In case something happens to the president, for example, you're it. You have to make a decision, and you have to make a decision fast. He didn't want the Secret Service detail close to him. So they were, way, way back in whatever kind of formation they were. And Kessler got this information, put it out there. And yet Biden, people would know this kind of stuff and elect this man president. His judgment is horrendous. And of course, now we've seen that it's genetic. His son's judgment is horrendous. Mm-hmm. And when we now have to look with a straight face and accept this is the fact pattern. Tell me if I'm wrong. Tell me if I'm embellishing it. The fact pattern is Joe Biden is the vice president. Joe Biden and Hunter Biden climb aboard Air Force Two. They land in China. They walk off the plane. They get back on the plane. They come back to America. And Hunter Biden has $1 billion-plus deal with the Chinese. Yet nothing there is out of line, and there is no conflict, and we should really trust Joe as president. That fact pattern doesn't add up to trust Joe as president. It just doesn't. And to think our country's collective judgment has gone that bad makes you think of something else. Did he really win the election? Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a lot of evidence that at the very least would have been more than enough for search warrants and a massive investigation to get answers to questions. That's all people are asking, and we deserve it. And if we went through 4 years of just the reverse of something that had nothing to start it, the Russia Trump investigation is what I'm talking about. And I said this back early on, and I'll say it again. There was nothing there. Those were FBI contact cases, and they were the simplest kind of counterintelligence case, and they were blown to smithereens. And in the midst of them, Democrats were committing all kinds of crimes, like destroying 30,000 government documents. But they didn't get charged with anything. And yet we spend 4 years looking at Russia Trump when we have right in front of us what looks to me like a major Chinese intelligence operation. Why? Because this is how they do all their intelligence operations. There's nothing mysterious here. And even the FBI says China's the threat. China, it's the China threat. Well, then fine, do something about it. You now have an insider in the White House who is directly in the middle of a conflict of interest. And he is. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what Anderson Cooper thinks. It doesn't matter what CNN and MSNBC and CBS and all these people think. That is a conflict of interest, and it should be front and center out in the middle of the news media every day until we get answers to questions about Joe Biden. And it's not good enough to say we've debunked that. There isn't anything to be debunked. The Chinese have targeted the Bidens.
Terry, I have to bring in too the problem in Ukraine and the fact that Joe Biden, we've got him on video at the Council on Foreign Relations talking about how he got the prosecutor who was investigating the organization that his son Hunter was working for and how he got rid of that prosecutor. I mean, if that isn't a conflict of interest in using improperly the power of the presidency or the vice presidency, I mean, it is so clear, and yet somehow that all goes away. The only thing they remember are the things that they want to remember, and they'll create things, they'll fabricate things out of thin air against someone who they hate. And now we're starting to see they're going after Dennis Montgomery because he exposed the hammer and scorecard and all these things that are part of the Russia collusion investigation and all the things that happened there. And yet somehow they, because they own the mainstream media, they get away with it. And none of us get away with those kind of things.
Oh, and we would. I'm so glad you brought that up, Dan, because my mind is racing through all this and I'm thinking of what I want to make as a point. And there's so much for us to talk about. And you're exactly right. And here's what really stands out about Ukraine. It kind of, as you were talking, I'm thinking, what is the best way to answer that? And I'm thinking of just being an FBI agent and you're sitting and you're talking to somebody in an interview. They want to brag about something that for a moment serves their purpose. And then when it backfires on them, suddenly they don't want to talk about it at all. It just vanishes. And that's exactly, look at President Biden. He liked to brag about that Ukrainian moment until he didn't. And that should tell us all we need to know. I mean, he doesn't even want people to remember that now. And that tells you a lot. It tells you about what was going on there. And President Obama did nothing to try and make that feel a little better to us. I mean, it was like, hey, Joe is Joe. He does what he does. I mean, this is sad because this man is conflicted on so many fronts. But let's just take that. That's kind of at the top. And we were talking, of course, we have been talking about China. That is a huge indicator of a problem. But we have been faced with the problem of the Chinese targeting of the Democratic Party and its success for a long time now. Just kind of backing up a little as we back out the door here, we have Eric Swalwell. Now, he was a big player in the Russia Trump and evidently a good buddy of Adam Schiff and all of these things and a big player this week in the second impeachment. He works out of an office just a few miles from the Lawrence Livermore National Weapons Lab in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's the congressman that has a lot of say in its budgets and a lot of things. He's sleeping with a Chinese spy. And the FBI, not even Swalwell, he didn't say anything. He didn't want to talk about this at all. But the FBI says all is well. We've approached him and talked to him. Everything's okay here. I don't accept that at all.
No.
Now, it may be that it's okay from the perspective that they stopped it, but before something drastic could happen, maybe, and I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, but that doesn't mean that everything's okay with Swalwell. his judgment is horrible. Mm-hmm. It also doesn't mean something else, which is much more significant. You don't hang out with a Chinese spy without the spy learning stuff. And I can guarantee you, she learned stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Not the first time we had a female Chinese spy work in the Bay Area. And I don't accept that there was no damage. I don't accept it for a minute. At the very least, he should have been pulled before Congress, and we should have been able, the public, us, we own our government. We should have been able to have our questions answered. We should not have had to see this guy this week. He shouldn't be doing anything like that right now. He should be at the very, very minimum, maybe selling soft drinks during a major break in a congressional hearing. That's what he should do for a while. Mm-hmm. Because he has crossed the line, and they did not.
Jerry. Yeah, and Terry, he certainly shouldn't be on the National Security Committee for the U.S. House.
Absolutely,
you know, not. The fact that he's involved in national security and he's that compromised, I mean, that's unbelievable.
Absolutely not. I couldn't agree more. And so, but what happened before Swalwell? Senator Feinstein, mm-hmm. 20 years is driven by a Chinese spy. You cannot make these things up.
No, you can't.
What does the FBI say? What does Dianne Feinstein say? Well, she doesn't say anything. She doesn't want to talk about it. What does the FBI say? Well, we don't think anything exchanged hands. That is absurd. And I'm trying to prevent my lips from forming the word just an outright lie because I have loyalty to the FBI. But I'm telling you, Dan, that is not the way the FBI should have treated the American public. To tell us that nothing happened and that he had no access to anything of any importance is ridiculous. Now, let me tell you what he had access to. He was her chauffeur. He was trusted by her. He knew where she was every single day during all those years. He knew the hours she was there. He knew the people she was meeting. He knew her emotions when she got in and out of the car. He knew when she was sick. He knew when she was well. He knew when she was upset by something. He knew when she was on the phone. He probably called up some of the numbers for her. He knew everything. And all of that made its way back to Beijing. Mm-hmm. You only need that kind of information to run off and multiply it tenfold. So to tell us nothing happened, it really bothers me. That is not the FBI that I was a part of. And it makes you wonder how deeply entrenched in the Democratic Party have the Chinese, the Soviets, the Cubans become. Because these things are not explainable to where you can just say nothing happened. It just doesn't work that way. And remember, again, intelligence operations go on as long as they can have them go on. They can go on for decades if they can make it happen. And they spend a lot of time and effort trying to do that. So once again, before we leave the topic, back in the days when Director Free was the director of the FBI and Janet Reno was the attorney general and Bill Clinton was the president, people need to remember, major scandal. It was called the campaign contribution case. We called it CAMCON in the Bureau. And it was Bill Clinton and Al Gore raising money from inside the White House. And Al Gore, in a major moment in that case, traveled to Los Angeles, went to a Buddhist temple, and was in meetings and in functions with known Chinese spies who were subsequently actually convicted. They were American citizens in this case. And subsequently convicted. And yet that case, because of a DOJ attorney, didn't get as far as it could have gotten. In fact, the DOJ attorney told the FBI, you're to steer clear of anything that goes near the White House. So you can see that we should be very suspicious as to what is going on in our government now and how we got to this point, because things do not happen overnight and they do not happen randomly. They happen because they intend for them to happen and they plan for them to happen. And I will tell you this, we should never, never underestimate the power and the effectiveness and the efficiency of intelligence operations run against us by the Chinese, by the Russians, by the Cubans. Never. And if we do and we take it for granted, we are truly fools.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I'm glad you're getting into this line too, Terry, because I really want to talk about, and we've got a half an hour, we can get into a pretty decent discussion, but I really want to talk about how badly our intelligence communities, our FBI, our CIA, the NSA, all the different intelligence agencies, how badly they've been compromised and infiltrated. And I want to get specifically into people like Brennan Comey, Clapper, Strzok, Ray, Page. I mean, there's a list of names a mile long there. And I really want to get into how exactly you see, and I'm asking your opinion on this, how you see this compromise and how it's really destroying our ability to even protect the American people.
That's a great question, Dan. And I think that if we go back to 9/11 and the attack on America, a number of changes came after that attack, and they really affected both law enforcement agencies, certainly at the federal level, and the intelligence community. One of the changes that affected the law enforcement community is the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. Once you created a government agency and you put a number of what I call law enforcement type responsible agencies in there, and just about all of them other than the FBI were put into DHS, then suddenly you lose the independence those agencies had to give opinions. So it all gets funneled through one opinion, a secretary of DHS. That's political in and of itself. And that's how you make bad decisions. If you start compounding the problem that we already had in the intelligence community, which is the threat was really defined by politicians. It wasn't defined by the facts of what the people were collecting in the street. And so if you have agencies now that start feeding that very topic with the political opinion that they know they want to give anyway, because of by virtue of who's in the White House, then now you've just lost a lot of strands of information coming into you, because intelligence analysts, by the way, are going to color their reports to get the most attention. They're not going to give you information which they think you're going to toss because you don't want to hear it. So you start getting a much more limited picture and viewpoint of what's going on. So I think the creation of DHS was a real problem. But what else happened in the aftermath of 9/11? Well, a few years into 9/11 and after the hearings, Robert Mueller became president, became director of the FBI. Mm-hmm. And Robert Mueller, very soon after he was appointed as director, and I know Robert Mueller too, I'm not saying he was not a hardworking guy, but he went up to Capitol Hill. And again, who did he meet up there? He met Patrick Leahy and Charles Grassley. And people can check this. It's not just me saying it. They said, look, if you want certain things from us for the FBI, then we're going to, and that means money, then we're going to take more of a hand in running the FBI. And in other words, it's the same old thing. Congress has money. They give you money. You do what they tell you, right? Well, the FBI never did that. The FBI never played that game. But they made it very clear, and these are the words they used. We want you to change the cowboy culture of the FBI. Now, what do you think that meant? It meant we're tired of the FBI telling us that it's independent and not going to give us what we want or do what we say or what we ask. And in effect, Robert Mueller traded up so much that he gave up the independence of the FBI. I think it was at that moment and in the follow-on years that the relationship between the FBI and political figures changed. And I think those were the years in which the FBI was compromised. There is no way that simple cases like what happened, for example, to the Clinton email case should have been so hard to work and should have resulted in such a mess. That should have been a very straightforward investigation. But you can tell, again, from the early days, nothing was worked on that case in the way it should have been worked. So I remember when I was a brand new agent, I had a very seasoned agent mentor say, look, here's what you can keep in mind. If you go to a field office, think about the crime problems there, think about the players out there. And when you go out to try to put a case together, regardless of what it is, whether it's a white collar case or a violent crime case or a counterintelligence case, think about this, that you have to go out and learn what is normal before you can detect the anomalies and the abnormal things which are going to put you on the trail of the crime and how it was committed. And that made perfect sense to me. And so when you then saw what was happening years later with Hillary Clinton's case, nothing was being done the way the FBI does it. That's the anomaly. And so you knew right away, you didn't have to get into the weeds. You knew something's wrong here. What was wrong is that the FBI had become politically compromised. Had you or I or Randy or anyone, had we destroyed 30,000 documents, emails? Had we called in all of our friends and said, hey, let's have a little talk here. And then our lawyers, we need to all get together because this is too many emails for me to destroy overnight myself. We would have all been prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Mm-hmm. But guess what? Instead, I think she had as many people in the room for her when she was interviewed by the FBI as the FBI agents did on their side. It should have been, guess what? Just like when they come in the door to talk to any of us, it should have been a couple FBI agents and Hillary Clinton and maybe her lawyer if that's what she wants. Okay, fine. Her lawyer's got to be there. That's it, right? Why would it be anyone else? And by the way, if it were her attorney, though, it wouldn't be somebody who helped her destroy documents. That's another thing entirely. But she got all those bennies, right? None of us would get mm-hmm. those. Did the Tea Party have that benefit during the Barack Obama administration? No. Lois Lerner and the IRS went all up
right.
and they didn't have any right to do anything. Did Carter Page or Roger Stone, did any of them have that kind of courtesy afforded to them? Well, of course not. And it shouldn't have been, but it shouldn't have been to her. And she really did something. She committed crimes. Mm-hmm. But that investigation, and maybe this was the hangup, they didn't even call them crimes. That was supposed to be a matter. We'll work on this matter. And that's exactly what the Attorney General of the United States told James Comey. And James Comey felt for some reason that he didn't need to say anything about that until he really was in a hole of his own. And then he decided to volunteer, 2 years later. Well, she asked me to call the email investigation a matter. Mm-hmm. Of course, that came after also a coincidence, a very random coincidence of two planes meeting on runways out in Phoenix. And one happened to carry the attorney general and the other happened to carry the former president. So we're just told these ridiculous stories that make no sense. So, they're lying. That's what they're doing. They're just lying. Mm-hmm. And so what happened to the FBI then? On the one hand, with DHS, you had kind of intelligence diluted and fed and becoming political. What you had with the FBI is you had the FBI literally being recast. It was rebuilt under Mueller to kind of do what it was told. And that's what it did. But in the process, it also was being subjected to the full range of propaganda to change the thinking of people promoted. In this book, people are going to read a story about the Comey letter. I call it the Comey letter. And it's very important, and I'll bring it up here. Unbeknownst to me when I was writing the book, and until I'd been on a couple of shows talking about it, I didn't know that the Comey letter was out there. And the author of it actually reached out to me and sent it to me and said, we tried to tell James Comey that Director Mueller led the FBI in the wrong direction. And they put a lot of examples in here, and some of them are FBI employees were upset that they were being treated by different standards. Thank you for putting that up.
Yeah, that's a great letter.
Yeah, it is. And I hope people, this letter is in the book. So I hope people, if they get the book, they can read this. But one of the examples that was in the letter is that there were some FBI employees who were in a, you know, they work in the cubicle type atmosphere, and they had, I guess, maybe religious verses, Christian verses or crosses or something up in their respective areas. And one day a supervisor came to these ladies and said, you need to take all of that down. Now, look, I worked in the FBI. I mean, this is the last thing that would ever happen in the FBI I worked in that prided itself on its fidelity, bravery, and integrity. These women said, well, why? Well, because some employees have complained that it makes them feel like they're working in a hostile work environment. Well, these ladies questioned that. And the whole thrust of this was happening at a time when the, quote, new FBI was spending maybe an entire week, maybe perhaps an entire month, celebrating inside the Bureau Gay Pride Month. Now, avoiding all the other things, I mean, this is not the kind of things I had to deal with when I was in the Bureau. But evidently, employees in the FBI who were gay were able to do all these things and spend Bureau money on all these functions and entertainment. But there were complaints made that people were uncomfortable because of these religious verses. And in the end, they had to take them down. That's a travesty. That is what is called equity, I guess. And that's what we've been talking about. Okay, that's the new brainwashing inside these agencies. Here's something that's very, very more concerning in a way, actually in every way. Remember the Fort Hood shooting in Texas involving the subject Nadel Hassan. He was a U.S. Army major. Following that shooting and all of the, there was controversy over it even when it happened. Evidently the fact pattern showed that Nadel Hassan had gone into that Army base that day and was yelling as he was shooting Ali Akbar. And so there were a lot of other things. He'd been in contact, for example, I think, with Al-Awlaki, and all of these things that had come out. But my point is, when all of this was put together in like an after-action report, part of it made its way to the FBI Academy, at Training Academy at Quantico. And this was put into a training exercise. And then the whole idea was you would go through the motions, but you would respond to what was in the training exercise and make judgments about what you might be facing. And so there was both a practical training of maybe what's happening on the scene with the violent part, but also the aftermath of, is this a terrorist act? If so, what kind? Well, in the training exercise, agency immediately noticed something that was missing, that was in the FBI's official report. And that was that Nadel Hassan had yelled, Ali Akbar. Mm-hmm. It was not in the training exercise. You would think that would be an important part of your ultimate judgments and maybe your decisions. But it was nowhere to be found. And it was pointed out to FBI headquarters by street agents, essentially, that and by the case agents, that this is not correct. This is a major fact that you've omitted. Well, they finally did put it in 8 months later. It took 8 months of complaining. So what does that tell you about what was happening in Mueller's FBI? Mueller's FBI was becoming compromised. I have a good friend. His name is Brian Shepard. Brian and I were partners in New York together. And Brian told me in the course of writing this book, and he's a very highly decorated FBI agent. And he told me in the course of writing this book, he said, Terry, you realize that if the FBI fails, America will not be far behind. And I will not forget that. And I put it in this book, and I attributed it to Brian in the book. But the point is, we used to count on the FBI as the last defense of our Constitution, of all of our civil liberties, of all of our rights. And we certainly counted on them to make sure politicians didn't take advantage of us, regardless of what they were out there doing and saying. And the FBI made mistakes over the years. I'm not going to sit here and tell you they didn't. But we always tried really hard to do what we were telling people we were doing and to make sure we told each other and reminded each other that we didn't take an oath to a political party. We didn't even take an oath to the FBI. we took an oath to the Constitution of the United States, and it's clear as it can be on every FBI agent's credential. And that is not happening now. The oath is not what is important. It's who is in office telling you what you're going to do. The example I gave you is nothing compared to what's to come. If they get their way and get this ideological, critical race theory type thinking in front of the FBI again and in front of America's police departments, then using the lever of if you don't do as we say, you won't get government grants for the kinds of things you need to protect your community and keep people safe. This is a tragedy that is going on here because, again, I can't emphasize enough, they are bringing an ideology into a government that is supposed to be for the people. And if anybody is supposed to be free of politics, it's the government bureaucracy. The government bureaucracy is no longer free of politics, and every one of us knows that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we sure do. Terry, I appreciate what you're saying here with the agency, but I have to tell you what's going on now with the Chinese influence in our country. I would absolutely love to have you talk about how important it is for Americans to wake up and realize just exactly how controlled we are now. In Washington, D.C., the Democrat Party and other parts of our country, how they're being controlled by the specter of communism, by the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, I think they control our media. They control big tech now. They control academia. They control the bureaucracy within our government. Are there areas that they don't control? If there are, I don't know what they are.
Dan, Legacy Entertainment, the Waldorf Astoria, AMC Theaters, all of these places, Micron Technology, I believe, gets money from China. All of these major corporations and companies. Now, they have nothing to do with the government, but they have a huge sway when it comes to public opinion and propaganda and technology. They're all owned by the Chinese government. And people don't realize that at all. The Chinese government owns some other major real estate properties here in the country. The Chinese government has relationships with colleges and universities where they're giving them a lot of money. The Chinese government entered into a $2 billion contract with Gavin Newsom in California after the virus to give California masks. And that became a disaster. The Chinese government was used after 9/11 by the state of California to bring in, concrete and stuff like that to literally rebuild some of the bridges that had collapsed out there. The Chinese government has reached deeply into our society in all kinds of various spheres. And the government certainly is right there in at the top of the ladder. And we talked earlier about the fact that it's not a coincidence that politicians in the Democratic Party obviously have been targeted and successfully targeted by the Chinese through the Chinese agents. The Chinese, back when I was at Lawrence Livermore Lab after I left the Bureau, were literally at that time, and that's close to 20 years now, they were doing the same kind of hacking and trying to get into important government websites and important government and gain access to important government information pertaining to the Department of Energy, pertaining to the water supplies in municipalities across the country. All of these things they were doing from the comfort and the security of being right there in Shanghai. And they have a huge effort to technologically get into American secrets, to technologically get into American companies, and to get into government agencies. And they do that 24/7. And they collect a huge amount of information. The FBI, for all it says and all it's not done, has consistently maintained that China is the number one threat internationally facing America. Bill Priestap, who was the former assistant director of the Counterintelligence Division, told Congress in a hearing a few years ago that China is out for nothing less than to present to the world an alternative model of how the world should be led and run. And that's by China and not by America. That's their goal. That's what he said. Mm-hmm. Christopher Wray just more recently said China is the number one threat internationally to America's existence. And if you look at the FBI's counterintelligence operations and look at just the last 5 or 6 years, at least two dozen Chinese citizens who are actually Chinese citizens in the U.S. spying on behalf of China, or American citizens of Chinese origin who were spying on behalf of China and taking information to them. All of that happened and these people were arrested, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. That just shows you the dimensions of the issue. More Chinese espionage agents were arrested in connection with those kinds of cases than any other country. And that's why the FBI is so concerned. In America's colleges and universities every year, we have hundreds of thousands of Chinese students coming in here, getting educations. They are loyal to China. People don't realize this either. And it's going to be this way because it's just the nature of the Chinese. They are loyal to each other. They are loyal to their government to a fault, unless you can somehow get them drug away from that, and or they're in Hong Kong and they now see what they have to face. But by and large, they're either very loyal or they're very afraid, because if they're over here, you can be sure the Chinese have their relatives over there and mm-hmm. they will lean on their family if they have to. Keep in mind something else that people have forgotten. They have forgotten Tiananmen Square. The Chinese government is probably the only major 20th century government that has killed its own people in when push came to shove. And we don't even know how many. We don't know if it was hundreds or thousands. But they didn't blink an eye when people in China decided they were going to try to confront their own government. Even the former Soviet Union watched their military blink when Boris Yeltsin climbed up on the tank and said no more. And the next 24 hours, we watched as the Soviet Union literally fell apart. And we watched not too long after as the Berlin Wall fell apart. That did not happen in China. And if the Chinese have their way, it is not going to happen now. So this is a different kind of adversary. And I think people don't understand that. They are in our companies and corporations. They are in our entertainment. Disney has billions of dollars. It's a family-owned company, family-owned corporation. But they want to operate in China. And by golly, they do. They have Disneyland in China, right? But they are now on the hook. They have to get by, and so they have a huge financial commitment there. So we're influenced by this, whether we seek to think we aren't or we don't. And it's going to get worse because the Chinese are going to turn up the heat with Joe Biden in office. And all we have to do is watch his policies and watch his actions and watch the orders that he signs. Let me get now to the worst part. I mean, this makes everything we've just talked about almost moot. We are getting ready to go down the road of climate change policies. We are literally getting ready in 20 years to be told, you're not going to be quite as mobile because there's not going to be gas for your cars. You're going to run your cars on electricity. We don't have an electric grid that and an industry here that helps us in America create jobs around that. That's all in China. The Chinese aren't going to get rid of gas and oil. I can guarantee you of that. And they know that we're fools if we try. But we're going to give up our energy independence to a world power that has doubled the size of their military, has made very clear what they want to do to America in the world stage. And we're now going to say, look, in 20 years, we're going to run on an all electric grid. Remember something, you and I can still be mobile in America and have that right when we have a gas to put in our car, right? If there's somebody out there that can pull the plug on the electricity, we're done. We're going to sit in the house and we're going to do what we're told. Saddam Hussein used electricity, okay? He used it to control the will of the people. He used food. All tyrants do. And right now, we are going down that road. You're going to be dependent upon the electric grid to do everything, to have power in your house. well, that's just not going to work. And it brings me to my final point, going back to those, that story I told you about the Lawrence Livermore lab 20 years ago. And I brought this up in a briefing. The Chinese are way, way ahead of us in even thinking about something called electric magnetic pulse technology. And what it essentially means is that they know all the secrets, and they've been building an industry to pull the plug on our military if they ever get in a fight with us. Let me tell you, they're ready to pull the plug on America's lights if we get in a fight several years out. This is what this really means. And yet we're watching Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden and all these other people talk about climate change like it's literally, it is their religion. Okay, it is replacing, and I like to say dethroning, God as their new religion, climate change and nature. And this is where we're at. But again, should we be surprised? Well, no, because long, long time ago, before we were even around, what was Marx worried about? Dethroning God and killing capitalism. And that is exactly what this brings us back to. There is no proof. There is no sufficient argument that America is either a victim of climate change or has not really considered.
We are 5 years away from fundamentally transforming
in the last 20 years. And yet, here we're now being told that we're no longer going to debate this with you people. We're telling you, and the world elite are telling you, this is the direction we're going to go in. So we have our hands full, but China sits astride all that and must be sitting back and thinking, wow, is this a big trick? Are they really believing all that they're doing? Or have we been that good? Well, they've been that good, but we've also been,
incredibly naive.
Yes.
Incredibly naive. And I want to wrap up with a statement that you kind of touched on, but the power elite are really the ones pushing this whole program. The useful idiots of the left, the people who believe this nonsense of communism, that believe all this crazy crap about environmental justice and the Green New Deal and all this other garbage, they all need to realize that we are being controlled and being fought by a group of the ultra, ultra powerful and rich that control every dollar in our world right now. And they are using us against one another to destroy our society and bring on something that they really truly want. And that is a technocratic, very, very low human population world that they can control everything for them and their families. I'd love to hear your opinion on that before we go out.
Sure. I spent several years in the FBI's Palo Alto resident agency. That's right there in the middle of Silicon Valley. We decided that people out there running these major corporations, this was back in the 80s and 90s, we decided that we had to go out and make sure that they weren't so naive about what was going on with intelligence services. And of course, at that point in time, it was all kind of aimed at the microchip industry. Okay. And so we began our crusade. We began going out to talk to these people, the smartest people in the room, in fact. And I have to say that the bottom line is, for the vast majority of them, it's that elite is a good word, but complete arrogance is the other word. They simply do not see themselves ever reaching a point in time when anyone is going to be smarter than them or anyone is going to outsmart them. And today that is, we've traveled a long way, and obviously they are now part of the group of people who are the global elite, who have made their way to use the United Nations. The United Nations kind of brings a lot of this together in a way, and use it to kind of bring peace to the world in that we'll all be having that same sense of equity in everything. And that, again, is that international solidarity aspect of communism, right? And so they've climbed aboard. But really, when you get down to it, it's just about one thing. They're at the top. They're flying on their private planes. They're making more money. Warren Buffett, you know, he could say all he wants about the environment, but what he did is he went out and bought thousands of new tanker cars so he could carry the oil across the land rather than to put it in a pipeline, right? It's all about money. And that's what all these people are about. They're about money, they're about power, and they're about telling everyone else what to do. Because whether we choose to admit it or not, there is a real tyrannical strain that runs through the high-tech industry, especially the new found high-tech industry of social media companies. And that's what we face. We face a lot of multiple challenges from a bunch of arrogant people who really don't understand America and have no interest in hopping in a car and driving across the heartland and shaking somebody's hand at the farm. They just don't. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how else I can be any clearer.
Yeah, no, that's spot on. Terry, I think Thumper's got the promotion on your book in their own words, and we'll play that real quickly.
Thank you.
Here.
Great.
We are 5 days away from fundamentally transforming the United States of America.
That we seek and prioritize profit and the accumulation of money. And to me, that ideology is not sustainable.
We need to start having race-conscious laws.
In some ways, I think maybe it's time for a third revolution.
All right. Fantastic. Well, I have to tell you, Terry, this has been a fascinating discussion. And all I can say is that, wow, I'd love to have you on again very, very soon. And I'd love to also have you on some other forums that we have. So I'm gonna stay in close touch with you. And let's see if we can do this again very, very soon. I look forward to meeting you in person, too.
That'd be great, Dan. And again, thank you. Thank you, Randy. And thank you guys for all that you've done and all that you do every day. I'm really proud to be part of this at this point. And I just think we have to just stick with it and stay at it.
Terry, it was an amazing, absolutely amazing presentation. And I want to say thank you. And I was able to find those documents.
You sure did. And man, boy, I breathed a sigh of relief.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, Terry, thank you again. And you're right. This is all an issue of connecting dots. And when people read and when people learn and when they listen to people like you who have been in the trenches and really understand the process, then we can start to learn what we're really up against and do something about it. So anyway, thank you again, and I'll look forward to seeing our listeners next week.
Well, thank you. And again, I'm grateful you all are out there. I really am. And take care and have a great rest of the weekend.
Thank you for coming on Patriot Soapbox. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, fellas.
Good day, everybody. How are we doing out there? I am, of course, here to pick up for Pat. He's still having his issues with the schedule lining up. So hopefully you'll be able to make it in a little bit. I told him I'm always happy to cover if he can't. That's what I sit in the background for, you know, just in case. So I was thinking we would actually play what I started early this morning. And that I think has about an hour left. And then that'll be about the halfway point. Hopefully Pat will arrive by then, if he's able to. But if not, we'll have time to discuss and go over some of this stuff. It's pretty crazy stuff. So for those of you who weren't awake this morning at like 5 a.m. I think we started at 6 a.m. Eastern time. This is something I've focus camera. There we go. This is something I've played a lady I've played before. She did her first interview back in 1998. Nan says, start from the beginning. I wish I could, but it's we'd be here all night. Just check it out. So this lady, Kay, Ms. Griggs, has done two major interviews. I think possibly maybe one or two more for written articles. But these are her two video/audio interviews. First one was in 1998, the second one in 2005. And the first one, as you can see, was nearly 8 hours long. The second one, which we were on, is 3 hours long. And I think we've got maybe an hour left. I thought I had it up here, but maybe not.